Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Climate change, the words of warning on the lips of many, including those of Pope Benedict XVI, who points out it's an issue of ethics as well as of economics and politics. An anthropologist explains the effects of climate change on indigenous peoples and consequently on the rest of humanity. And Father Jim Brand reflects on the very special relationship the Native Americans have with Mother Earth. Pope Benedict XVI's voice is sounding out stronger and stronger as he continues to urge mankind to adopt lifestyles that respect creation.
The justified concern about threats to the environment, present in so many parts of the world, is reinforced by Christian hope, which commits us to working responsibly for the protection of creation.
That was a passage from his apostolic exhortation Sacramentum Caritatis, and in a message to participants of a seminar in the Vatican on climate change, the Pope said that the main victims of global warming would be the Earth's poorest inhabitants. And this, he pointed out, makes the issue an ethical one as well as an economic and political one. Benedict said he hoped the seminar would help spur research and promote lifestyles, models of production and consumption based on respect for creation and the real needs of sustainable progress. He also encouraged the work of scientists and experts, describing it as of substantial importance, with repercussions above all on the weakest members of society. Now, if you have been listening to my programs this year, you will certainly have noticed that the issue of climate change is of great concern to me as well. During these past months, I have spoken to many experts regarding the problem and discovered that the effects of climate change are many and wide-ranging, and that there are many different angles you can take to examine them.
There's another group of people spread across the world on every continent to whom we give the name of indigenous people.
Sister Marjorie Keenan, a former member of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, is an expert on environmental issues and policies.
They have a special relationship with the land, an age-old respect for it. It is part of their very identity. We have to learn to listen to them. What do they have to teach us about the land?
Yes, that's exactly what the program is about today. Indigenous peoples, the ones in the immediate front line of vulnerability of climate change, that have much to teach us. In fact, according to Pablo Ezeguire, an anthropologist who works at the International Agricultural Research Center, Bioversity International, indigenous peoples must be integrated into discussions of climate change and policy formation for the good of us all.
The people living at the margins, the people, for example, living around the polar regions, they had been noticing climate change for the last 40 years. The decrease in the ice, the new patterns of migration of animals, you know, the reindeer. They had been noticing the thawing that had been taking place earlier and earlier every year. But nobody was listening to these people, even though they would have been providing very detailed information. The same with the people living in mountains or desert margins about the what was happening to the increasing unpredictability of climate events. So my interest now is not simply to find technological solutions, but also to find solutions where these people living at the margins can be part of the solution, and that there, the importance of keeping these ways of life. I like to think of these communities as early warning systems, but we didn't listen, I don't think. So I think we need to establish a dialogue where scientists and these traditional communities who have long-term knowledge can begin to share information, because right now the patterns of climate change have become so severe that even the survival of these people in the circumpolar regions, for example, or at the margins of rainforests or in deserts, is at risk.
Actually, speaking to Pablo, I soon realized he had some extremely interesting things to say. Let's take a step back, I said. Why don't you start by explaining exactly what it is that you do?
As an anthropologist, I work on how people use plants, how people use their environments and their particular adaptations to those environments. So I work, for example, with indigenous groups in high mountain areas or in tropical rainforests or at desert margins. In all of these environments, which appear quite difficult to survive in, and yet people have lived in these environments for thousands of years and in many cases have maintained them in a fairly productive way, which we're seeing increasing strains and difficulties in managing these environments as the world becomes more crowded and as our knowledge about how to use our natural resources is increasingly eroded.
So you're trying to protect the ancient knowledge of these people who know how to use the diversity of their regions?
Yeah, it's a lot of this knowledge is something that's been acquired over time, over several generations. Specific knowledge about different types of plants, those that are adapted to soils, either to grow with very little rainfall. And this knowledge is, in fact, quite ancient. But I think one of the things that we don't realize is that people living in these environments have to be very flexible and very innovative as well, so that there's a lot of this exchange of information and plants in particular that has taken place. And people take new information, take new plants, and adapt them to these new and difficult environments in ways that we might not have imagined. It's very difficult, for example, to explain to someone in southern Italy, for example, that tomatoes are not indigenous to Italy, but in fact they did take tomatoes, which are originally from the New World, were domesticated by the native peoples of the Americas, and tomatoes were taken to southern Italy, and they actually acquired new traits and characteristics that are important worldwide. And similarly, other plants like barley has come to the Americas and has been adapted there. So it's not just we have to, as our starting point, protect that traditional knowledge, but also you see it as a way of adapting to new circumstances and to including new opportunities.
Pablo explained that the exchange of information, together with a profound respect for biodiversity, yields precious indications in the fight against hunger and poverty.
Why is diversity so important globally?
Precisely because the world is so varied and so different, and it's changing so quickly. Some of these changes with climate change, for example, are not really ones we would like to see. They're a result of several hundred years now, the last, say, 150 years, of a real lack of concern for the fundamental processes in nature and in the world about adaptation and the use of soil, the use of water, even what we've done to the air. So given that these changes are taking place much more rapidly than we would have considered, and in ways that we can't predict, having some diversity in our crops is very important for adapting to these future changes. Because if the world is becoming drier, where are we going to find those crops that are adapted to low rainfall? If growing seasons are going to be shorter or longer, or right now we're seeing, for example, spring is coming a month earlier than it used to. There are some varieties that mature early, some varieties of plants that mature late. And a lot of these are being, I guess, the custodians of some of these plants are these traditional societies living in environments that are marginal or that were, you know, somewhat inaccessible. So we really need to connect with these people and their knowledge and find ways to support their ways of life in these areas.
I asked Pablo to give me a few examples of how climate change has had an impact on his work.
For example, we work on a lot of the high mountain areas, which were marginal to agriculture. And for example, in those areas, which have always been difficult, climate change has aggravated some of the problems of low rainfall, for example. Now, these areas, which used to rely on snowmelt for water to irrigate the crops, as these glaciers in the high mountains are being, well, they're melting away, so that this rainwater is no longer available. So people are having to shift their agricultural practices, or a lot of the things that they used to do, moving animals from the low areas to the high areas in the summer. These patterns are being changed dramatically by climate change as the seasons become shorter and shorter. And what's happening in many cases is people are losing some of their options. If you can no longer move animals to the high mountains when the grass begins to dry out on the lowlands, that really limits your possibility to keep as many animals. And these were often the insurance that they had in times of hunger and scarcity. So there's that in some of the rainforest regions, for example. As the rainforest shrinks, some of the access to many of the plants that they used as medicines, that people might have used as medicines, or the gathering of fruits, becomes more and more difficult, so that their health is often put at risk because they don't have access to modern health facilities. So the forest was really an area where they relied upon for their medicines and their well-being. A lot of the animals that they hunted, many of these are no longer available. So the drying out of forests, the shortening of growing seasons, is affecting in a disproportionate way the poor around the world. I think the more developed societies have ways of coping. But for the poor, the more you restrict in their environment, the less options that they have.
Are our governments concerned, and are they doing anything to help these people?
Well, there is a growing concern from the International Panel on Climate Change, for example. But one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is to see that some of this traditional knowledge of the people living in these difficult areas is brought into this discussion. Because it's been a scientific debate in the main, and surely some countries are making particularly the richer countries, are making some precautions, for example, through their gene banks, developing new varieties through genetic engineering that will be drought resistant. My interest now is not simply to find technological solutions, but also to find solutions where these people living at the margins can be part of the solution, and that the importance of keeping these ways of life, because they were, in a sense, I like to think of these communities as early warning systems. They were living at the margins, you know, so they saw the spread of deserts well before, in many ways, the global scientific community was paying attention. They saw the melting of the polar ice caps. They were among the first to call our attention to it. But we didn't listen, I don't think. So I think we need to establish a dialogue where scientists and these traditional communities who have long-term knowledge can begin to share information, because right now the patterns of climate change have become so severe that even the survival of these people in the circumpolar regions, for example, or at the margins of rainforests or in deserts, is at risk. So they also need the help of scientists to be able to survive in those areas. And they have a cultural right to live where they do. This is where their culture is developed, and their particular way of life, I think, merits our respect and support.
In a way, you're giving voice to these people. Is anyone else doing that?
Yes, they do have a voice in certain organizations, such as the United Nations. They do have a voice in some negotiations, for example, on intellectual property rights and their particular rights to their traditional knowledge systems. But it's what I'd like to see much more than just recognizing their rights, is recognizing the central role that they play for all of us as a planet, as a community of people that have to survive in a world that's increasingly damaged by our own activities, that they need to be a voice in the scientific debates as well, that their information, their knowledge was ignored for so long. You know, their areas are considered marginal to agriculture or marginal to development, but in fact, they're there for a reason, because these environments provide, you know, rich ways of life that we've never considered. So I don't want to separate their way of life from the scientific knowledge and information that they can contribute, nor do I want science to ignore the plights of these people and say, well, the world is changing, it's getting hotter and it's getting drier, so people shouldn't live near the deserts and we shouldn't be living in high mountains. One of the unique attributes of our species is that we do occupy a lot of different environments. We're not constrained by biology to live because we have culture, because we have, you know, and even in many cases, the particular spiritual beliefs of people living in mountains. The mountains to them are sacred places, certain mountains, certain parts of the forest are sacred places. And these have been important ways, I think, as a humanity has defined its way in the world. And I'd hate to see that diversity be diminished. At the same time, we're also diminishing the resources of our planet. I think the two have to go together.
Pablo, very clearly, is passionate about his work and nurtures a deep respect for the peoples he has learned to know. I asked him whether he's optimistic about things to come.
Well, I'm optimistic every time I work in these areas and I see the creativity of these people. You go to these areas and these communities, it's not a pessimistic point of view. They rely on a lot of their own creativity and their culture, and you still see these kinds of, you know, the inevitable optimism, I think, of the human species. And so if we look more to them and listen to them, I don't think we get such a pessimistic view, because people are incredibly able to adapt and they have a remarkable ability to be creative and find creative solutions. It's when we don't listen to people and we don't listen to their experiences that we can develop a very negative and insular and closed and negative view of our situation. And I'd like to just open this dialogue, and I'm hopeful that this dialogue is beginning and that it's not just a question of helping these people as a type of charity, because I don't think that's what they want. They want to be heard and recognized for their creativity and the strength of their cultures and their particular systems of knowledge.
And now our friend, Father Jim Brand, spiritual director of the Pontifical Beta College, stays very much with the theme of this program, as he speaks with love and respect of the Native Americans and of their very special relationship with Mother Earth.
Hello, this is Father Jim. Last week I was thinking of the world being a common wealth, because God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put us to care for it. And there are many nations in the world who've cared for their mother. And one of the great nations is the Native American. I've been privileged to work with for 8 summers in a reservation in South Dakota. Here is the testimony of Chief Seattle, which you may have heard before, but it bears repeating. He was from the Northwest of the United States, and I believe in about the 1830s or 40s wrote a series of letters to the American president. The great chief in Washington sends word he wishes to buy our land. The great chief also sends words of friendship and goodwill. That's kind of him, since we know he has little need of our friendship in return. But we'll consider your offer. We know that if we don't sell, the white man may come with guns and take our land. How can you buy or sell the sky and the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. If we don't own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing and humming insect is holy in the memory and experience of my people. The sap which courses through the trees carries the memories of the red man. But the white man's dead forget the country of their birth when they go to walk among the stars. But our dead never forget this beautiful earth, for it is the mother of the red man. We're part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The deer, the horse, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices of the meadows, the body heat of the pony and man, all belong to the same family. So when the great chief in Washington sends word he wishes to buy our land, he asks much of us. The great chief sends word he'll reserve us a place so that we can live comfortably to ourselves. He'll be our father, we'll be his children. So we'll consider your offer to buy our land, but it will not be easy, for this land is sacred to us. This shining water that moves in the streams and rivers isn't just water, but the blood of our ancestors. And if we sell you land, you must remember it's sacred. You must teach your children that it's sacred. And each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. The rivers carry our canoes and feed our children. And if we sell you our land, you must remember and teach your children that the rivers are our brothers and yours, and you must henceforth give the rivers the kindness you'd give any brother. The red man's always retreated before the advancing white man as the mist of the mountains runs before the morning sun. But the ashes of our fathers are sacred. Their graves are holy ground. So these hills, these trees, this portion of the earth is consecrated to us. Oh, we know the white man doesn't understand our ways. One portion of the land's the same to him as the next. For he's a stranger, comes in the night, takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth isn't his brother, but his enemy. When he's conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's graves behind. He doesn't care. He kidnaps the earth from his children. He doesn't care. His father's graves and his children's birthright are forgotten. He treats his mother, the earth, and his brother, the sky, as things to be bought, plundered, sold like sheep or bright beads. His appetite will devour the earth and leave behind only a desert. I don't know. Our ways are different to your ways. The sight of your cities pains the eyes of the red man. But perhaps it's because the red man's a savage and doesn't understand. There's no quiet place in the white man's cities. No place to hear the unfurling of leaves in spring or the rustle of insects' wings. But perhaps it's because I'm a savage and I don't understand. The clatter only seems to insult the ears. And what is there to life if a man cannot hear the lonely cry of the whippoorwill or the arguments of the frogs around a pond at night? I'm a red man and I don't understand. The Indian prefers the soft sound of the wind darting over the face of a pond and the smell of the wind itself cleansed by a midday rain or scented with the pinyon pine. The air is precious to the red man, for all things share the same breath. The beast, the tree, the man, they all share the same breath. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also received his last sigh. And the wind must also give our children the spirit of life. And if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred. It's a place where even the white man can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow's flowers. So we'll consider your offer to buy our land. If we decide to accept, I'll make one condition. The white man must treat the beasts of this land as his brothers. I'm a savage and I don't understand any other way. I've seen 1,000 rotting buffaloes on the prairie, left by the white man who shot them from a passing train. I'm a savage, and I don't understand how the smoking iron horse can be more important than the buffalo that we kill only to stay alive. What is man without the beasts? If all the beasts were gone, men would die of a great loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts soon happens to man. All things are connected. Teach your children what we've taught our children, that the earth is our mother. And whatever befalls the earth, befalls the sons of the earth. This we know. All things are connected. But we'll consider your offer to go to the reservation you have for my people. We'll live apart and in peace. It matters little where we spend the rest of our days. Our children have seen their fathers humbled in defeat. Our warriors have felt shame, and after defeat they turn their days in idleness and contaminate their bodies with sweet foods and strong drink. It matters little where we pass the rest of our days. They're not many. A few more hours, a few more winters, and none of the children of the great tribes that once lived on this earth, or that roam now in small bands in the woods, will be left to mourn the graves of a people once as powerful and hopeful as yours. Where's the thicket? Gone. Where's the eagle? Gone. And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt? The end of living and the beginning of survival. So we'll consider your offer to buy our land. If we agree, it'll be to secure the reservation you've promised there. Perhaps we may live out our brief days as we wish. But when the last red man has vanished from this earth, and his memory is only the shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, these shores and forests will still hold the spirits of my people. For they love this earth as the newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we've loved it. Care for it as we've cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you take it. And with all your strength, with all your mind, with all your heart, preserve it for your children and love it as God loves all. One thing we know, our God is the same God. This earth is precious to him. We may be brothers after all. We shall see. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.